From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Frederica Matthews Green, author of Real Choices, Listening to Women, Looking for Alternatives to Abortion. Let's now join Hank and Frederica in their conversation.
What do you think America would look like without abortion?
If there wasn't legal abortion, I think that it would compel those who should be responsible in an unplanned pregnancy to resume some of that responsibility. That would include not only the father of the child, but her own parents, her friends, her boss having to be more flexible in her case, and everybody would have to evolve some response to it. And I think that's one of the reasons that people like having abortion legal, is that it's the easiest solution to the problem for everybody else in her life. You know, it's like nobody has to, you know, change the schedule of who comes in on Tuesday. The boyfriend doesn't have to change anything. Her parents don't have to be embarrassed. Nobody has to change anything except inside the body of the woman. And in a way that's very anti-feminist to, you know, here's a social problem. Well, we'll go inside the woman's body and fix it there and not inconvenience anyone else. Our extreme atomization as a culture has been aided and abetted by legal abortion. And if it were to go, I think the feminists would begin to call for the support that they should have from the larger community. I've said that abortion is like a funnel because it resolves all the questions at once. You know, it just wipes the slate clean. They used to accuse us of wanting to turn back the clock, but abortion does almost literally turn back the clock. And like a time machine, it puts her in the condition she was before she got pregnant. Nobody has to grieve over that except her, privately, all alone. This extreme atomization of our culture and the washing our hands of responsibility for each other, it's bearing lots of bad fruit in lots of ways. If abortion was illegal, it would no longer be possible to do that. We would have to acknowledge the needs of pregnant women and adjust. Yeah, everybody adjust just a little bit all around so that this is possible for her. The burden is not on her alone to prepare for this new coming child.
You sort of touched on this already, but what about someone who's a skeptic who says that if America made abortion illegal, then this would benefit the rich because the rich could go somewhere else in the world, and then the poor would be harmed because they don't have anywhere else to go?
Isn't that just the stupidest argument? Yes, you're right. I certainly do hear that. And it is entirely parallel to, if you make murder illegal, then rich women will still be able to hire assassins to get rid of their husbands. Poor women can't hire assassins. They will just have to kill their husbands by some other way that may not work. They might get injured in the process of killing their husband. What a terrible thing. So we have to keep murder legal. It's a non-moral and even non-logical way of approaching the problem.
Yeah, the illustration just, I mean, that's the answer. Illustrations like that are powerful. I mean, to be able to take the arguments and then break them down by way of illustration, you really don't have to say much because it just makes it, as you said, self-evidently absurd or stupid.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately, Hank, actually, about how everything is easier to understand if we use illustrations. And that arguing merely rationally, arguing about ideas or arguing about philosophy, that doesn't have a lot of sticking power. It tends to get shed before too long. But if you can put an image in someone's mind, it sticks there forever. You're a writer and communicator, and so am I. And I'm sure you, like me, I have been surprised at the things I've written that became sticky, so to say, and keep showing up and being repeated in other contexts. Like the thing you started out with, my analogy of a woman wants an abortion like an animal caught in a trap wants to gnaw off its own leg. I didn't anticipate that that would be something that was quoted and quoted here, there, and everywhere, and even in pro-choice publications.
I was thinking, as you were speaking about Whoopi Goldberg, who employed the abortion argument in suggesting that abortion rights advocates would take pro-lifers more seriously if they were willing to adopt babies who are slated for abortion. And I think just in the same way that you used an illustration, you can use an illustration in this particular case by saying that the fallacy becomes obvious when it's put in different words. So if, for example, you won't adopt my babies, don't tell me I can't kill them.
Yes, yes, that's right. That's right. And you know this too, although not everyone does, but the demand for babies is huge. Everybody wants to adopt babies. There are tens of thousands of couples waiting and hoping that they can adopt a baby. Any color, any condition, babies born with spina bifida, babies that are certainly going to die within a year. The list is very, very long. Babies with Down syndrome, as charming and sweet as they are. You know, there are long lists of people who would love to adopt a baby with Down syndrome. But babies hardly ever become available for adoption. It's very rare. You know, this was one of the funny things I learned in the Common Ground discussions, was that both pro-lifers and pro-choicers felt that it would be a good thing if women considered adoption. If they would give their child for adoption, the child could go to a family that maybe has been waiting years in hopes of eventually bringing a child to their home. And the woman could go ahead and follow the plan of her own life and really do something heroic in that. Both pro-life and pro-choice agreed on that, and the pregnant woman almost always disagrees. It is the last choice. People who do counseling in pregnancy care centers say, if you mention adoption to the mother, to the pregnant woman, it looks to her like the worst choice, because if she has the abortion, mentally it's like the child never existed and she's gotten rid of it. If she raises the child, she can love it and care for it. If she gives the child for adoption, though, it looks to her like abandonment. And perhaps she herself has some scars from being abandoned. And she worries that the child may not be treated right. It's a weird thing, because it's like her nascent attachment to the child and wanting it to have a good life. It's like she can't fight that completely. That's right there. It's making her concerned about her child's life if it was adopted. But then she makes this irrational decision that, well, I'll just kill it instead of letting it go to an adoptive family. So, of all the things that are wrong with the argument that, you know, if only pro-lifers would adopt these babies, they have no idea of how many couples are hoping to adopt a baby, and they're just not available.
Yeah, I want to get back to that subject in a bit, but perhaps you can, in the meantime, talk about contraception. You make a point that instead of the expected reduction in teenage pregnancies, greater adolescent involvement in family planning programs was associated with significantly higher teenage pregnancy rates.
Yes, yes. And you're talking about my book, Real Choices, which I must confess was published in 1994. So a lot of the statistics, a lot of that kind of analytical part of the book would need to be updated. But this was definitely true, that all the emphasis in the schools from middle school upward on when you have sex, you need to do this. You need to use contraceptives. You need to be sure you're safe and you're protected against disease and one thing after another. And all this emphasis is impressing on these young people that they're supposed to have sex. It's like, well, we know you're going to do it, so here we are. So the little girl that doesn't want to do it feels like the whole world is against her, and she should listen to her body because apparently she's supposed to want to do it, and then she should go ahead and do it. And, you know, a lot of times it doesn't end well for these girls, but they're launched on a lifetime habit of unwed sex and sex without commitment. And it's been a disaster for women. There's huge amounts of unhappiness among women because of exactly this assumption. But the emphasis on contraception is, in a way, what starts them out.
Unpack the cliche. We're talking about slogans and paradoxes, but cliches as well. One that you've mentioned is that girls give sex in order to get love and that boys give love in order to get sex.
Yes, that's an old saying, and I think it does have a lot of truth to it, that girls are willing to have sex with boys if only the boys will love them. And then they're heartbroken when it turns out what was attracting the boy was the craving to have sex.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Frederica Matthews Green. No one wants an abortion as she wants an ice cream cone or a Porsche. She wants an abortion as an animal caught in a trap wants to gnaw off its own leg. When Frederica Matthews Green's essay containing that line was published, pro-life leaders began quoting it. But it started showing up in pro-choice publications too. It seems that the two sides agree on one thing. Abortion is a miserable choice. Be sure to read Real Choices, Listening to Women, Looking for Alternatives to Abortion by Frederica Matthews Green. Call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org. With over 500,000 copies in print, Hank Hanegraaff's Bible Answer books were born out of his many years of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. He's taken his on-air answers to questions and chiseled them until only the gems emerge. Questions involving biblical interpretation, cults, science, ethics, apparent contradictions, and much more. This remarkable collection of concise answers is now even better. My goal, says Hank, is to take the complex and make it simple and memorable. Receive your copy of the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated, as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Frederica Matthews Green, in their conversation.
That's an old saying, and I think it does have a lot of truth to it, that girls are willing to have sex with boys if only the boys will love them. And then they're heartbroken when it turns out what was attracting the boy was the craving to have sex. It's an extremely strong craving in the teenage years and almost overwhelming to the boys. And they're not really that interested in the girl, you know, half an hour after they have sex with her. So it's two desires conflicting with each other. And making sex very cheap, very easy to get. You don't have to economize and save up. It's right there. Deflating the value of sex, making it easy, making it free, free sex, free love, works against the women because now the women don't have as much bargaining power. Now it's assumed that they will just give away sex continuously, no matter how the boys treat them. So it's one more of the things that have backfired on feminism and actually rendered the situation for women and girls worse than it was before.
Wow. What category of women, and this is a real setup question, I mean, there's an obvious answer to it. What category of women have the highest levels of sexual satisfaction? Or maybe it's not so obvious. I don't know.
I think it is so. And I think that's been found over and over through the decades. It's that the women who are most sexually satisfied, who respond, you know, check that top box when they're responding to a survey about it, are women who are married. And in fact, married people just have a lot more sex than unmarried people do. And so it's something to do with that sense that a married woman has of being safe and being cared for. It's a weird kind of journey or passage that I thought about when I was writing Real Choices, which is that the girl's, the woman's drive is all about safety and protection because she's going to conceive and she will give birth. And so she wants a safe environment and a good, steady guy. And she knows that he's going to stick with her if he's wildly in love with her. So his attitude of loving her, his willingness to give an expensive engagement ring, expensive as far as he's concerned, all of this evidence is reassuring to her because she's looking for safety. And boys, as we know, are looking for danger. They want to do all kinds of crazy things. And hopping from one girl to the next also comes very easily to them. So the attraction, bringing the two together, it has a different motivation on each side. And the thing is that eventually men and boys find that they are lonely. You know, I found, Hank, a few years ago I noticed when I was giving a talk, if I mentioned the word loneliness, it was like the audience would freeze. I was very surprised at this. The epidemic of loneliness is so heartbreaking today, partly because of the triumph of free love. You don't have that motivation of, and then we'll be able to have sex. Instead, it's been so cheapened and so, quote, free, and people have been so disconnected from each other that it has left a lot of people very lonely. They don't really know how to go about selecting a spouse or how to continue a marriage once they're in one. They have maybe never seen a good marriage. They may have never seen one. So we're depriving these people and setting up a generation for perpetual loneliness, and we're not teaching them how they could reverse that. But all the emphasis in our culture on consumerism and on sexual images surrounding us are designed to keep people dizzy and craving and uncertain and thinking of themselves as little atoms bouncing around inside a molecule with no real connection to anyone else.
Let me ask you a very shallow question. And that shallow question is, should we want to wake up next to someone sexy, or is it better to want to wake up next to someone who is kind, particularly when you think about this question from the perspective of time?
That's so true. And I thank you for the setup because you're quoting me.
I am.
Our craving to really bond with another person, to trust another person, to really merge our lives is so deep. And that's not what the culture throws at us or encourages us to do. We're always encouraged just to keep having a good time. But the line is that what we want most of all is not to wake up next to somebody sexy tomorrow morning, but to wake up next to somebody kind 50 years from tomorrow morning. We want to have those deep-rooted relationships that you can go through all the ups and downs of life together with someone you really love. That's what we're made for. Humans, it seems, are one of the few mammals that bond for life, if they can find a partner for life. Not many others do. Many of them are, you know, just with a different partner every year. But it seems that we do bond for life, and I've puzzled over why that is. Because if it's the deer that's going through your backyard and chewing up your landscaping, the male and the female deer meet and part. We remember from Bambi, and the mother raises the fawn, and Bambi finally has a glimpse of his father at some point. So that's very different lines. Why is it that humans don't do that? Why do human couples stay together after they're past the age of bearing children? And I think it has to do with that deep hunger to merge with another person in many ways other than sexually, to truly become one with them. I know you've had a beautiful marriage, and so have I, and we both know how rare that is these days. I'm going to be 50 years married in 2024, and what a wonderful time, and especially because we were both atheists and hippies, and on our first date, my husband said, I'm such a feminist that if I ever get married, I want to hyphenate my wife's name to my name. And he did. So he's Father Gregory Matthews Green, just like he was the Matthews, I was the Green. We were just so committed to all of that. And yet our Lord led both of us to him and seized our hearts and made us fall in love with the Lord even more than we love each other.
Mm.
And what a wonderful basis, what a wonderful foundation that has been for our marriage.
You know, that's something you ought to talk about as well in this context. How significant is the sacrament of marriage? My son David got married in our backyard. And then when he became Orthodox, he realized the significance of sacrament and he got remarried in the church.
Oh. Good. I'm so glad. Yes, the Orthodox sacrament of marriage is, of course, extremely ancient. And what's different about it compared to Western forms of marriage is that the husband and wife really don't say anything. They actually don't take vows. It is rather that they appear, they have this sacramental service. It's about 45 minutes long. And it is the priest, the sacramental presence of the priest, it is the ancient church that says to them, now you are married. They walk around the table with crowns on their heads, and they go around it three times, and then they are a married couple. So it doesn't have to do with their own ability to vow something or other, because we're weak. But the church has pronounced that now you are married. It's a beautiful service.
It is a beautiful service. I get so emotional when I see the sacrament of marriage unfold in the context of the church, which is the epicenter of the universe. I want you to talk as well, Frederick, about the problems of single parenting. You know, how necessary it is for men and women to complement one another in the raising of a child. So when you have gender undifferentiated parenting, you have a problem right at the outset.
Yes, yes. And I think that's so obvious that you have to be, you know, extremely committed to being one-sided to think that it's not. It's been a strange thing because it's so obvious that being a single mother is not possible in many ways. It's simply too stressful and that it doesn't serve the child well. It's so much better if both parents are there in the home. And you're not allowed to say that because people immediately say, why are you judging single mothers? Why don't we support them? Why don't we say how great they are? And You know, and it is true. They are heroic. They're trying to do something that is fairly impossible, as I said. But that doesn't mean it's good. You know, maybe the other side, the fact that it is so difficult, it ought to be an indication to us that it really isn't natural, that it is not planned that the wife, the mother, would have no support whatsoever from the husband and do it all herself. Or even if the support is only financial, that's still not enough.
We've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Frederica Matthews Green, author of Real Choices, Listening to Women, Looking for Alternatives to Abortion. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of Real Choices, Listening to Women, Looking for Alternatives to Abortion. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org.